This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. This is Feminist Fridays on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Julia Jacobs. Diagnosed with polio when she was only one, Dr. Felicia Chang's nerves were damaged by the virus, which impacted the ability of her right leg to grow. Overcoming great self-loathing and bitterness brought on by dealing with her condition, Dr. Felicia is now a fun-loving soul. But she has also devoted her life to becoming a palliative doctor, helping terminally ill patients live out their final days in comfort, and also providing the right support to her patients' caregivers. She joins me now to share her story. Welcome, Dr. Felicia. How are you today?
Thank you very much, Juliet. I'm fine. Thank you for your invitation.
Yes, I read your story in so many different media outlets, and I was just, you know, so inspired to speak to you as well. Can we go back to the start? You know, as I mentioned earlier, you were only 1 year old when you contracted polio. And I read in your blog that you said your parents actually tried to go to every possible doctor that came their way to try and find a cure.
Yes, I remember that when I was very young, when I was contracted about 1 year old. So at the time, I couldn't walk. So dad and mom has been trying to look for Western doctors. We went to BOMO. We went to physiotherapies. We went to Sensei. Yeah, it was a tough time for all of us, but I'm very grateful for my parents because when I can't walk, they have to carry me around. In the past, we don't have good highways. You know, we have to travel by bus because we're not from a wealthy family. Mm-hmm. So dad and mom used to, like, you know, we travel late at night to different places in Malaysia and Singapore to seek treatment. Wow. And they were really carrying me on their shoulder to seek treatment at a time.
Wonderful parents you have. And are you an only child, or do you have brothers and sisters as well?
I have one sister and two brothers. I'm the third in the family.
You're the third in the family. Okay, so how... And then I remember also reading in, you know, your blog how you mentioned that, you know, none of these, there was no cure, right? And how did that make you feel, you know, as a child going to all these different, you know, these different potential cures which didn't quite work out?
I think initially there was a lot of hope. You know, you go to this different promises, doctors say, but Western doctors have already said that there's no cure. But of course, from tradition, from our culture, we say, oh, maybe, you know, we seek for different treatment, there's hope. But I think the heartbreaking part is every time when it didn't work, okay, my little heart was broken over and over again. So, but I'm very grateful because I'm at the age of 8, we actually met one sensei from Terengganu. He's a very old gentleman, and my leg, he's able to kind of straighten it. So that made me able to wear some shoes. Okay. All right, so that changes a lot of, I think that changes me a lot because then I'll be able to try to walk with crutches and all that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the thing is, like, when I was very young, the heartbreaking part is when your hope is crushed over and over again.
Yeah. How did you even, you know, at such a young age, how did you even work through all of those kind of, you know, well, disappointments really, right?
I think my family, I think my parents has been very supportive. My parents never think that I'm handicapped. You know, I was made to do chores at home, you know. I was punished just like anyone else, you know.
No special treatment.
We wash our own school shoe, you know. We water the plants, you know. And my siblings, yeah, we have our normal sibling fight, but they're very protective of me. But I think school played a very important role in developing my self-confidence. Mm-hmm. My teachers and my friends are absolutely amazing. They never treated me differently, but yet they know that certain time that I can't walk too much. Mm-hmm. So my friends used to go to canteen to get food for me, you know. Yeah. We used to sit, then they were accompany in the swing or next to the field to just have food with me. So I'm blessed because throughout my younger age, I have very supportive family and friends and teachers.
So that's wonderful to hear that you had so much support. But did you also ever face any form of discrimination, or, you know, kids, they can just be sometimes very cruel people as well, right? Because there's no filters, right? You know, did you ever have to, face those sorts of things?
Yeah, I think you're right. Children, I think it's out of their ignorance that they use very hurtful words like pai ka means you can't walk, you know. There are things like, you know, you're crippled, you know, why can't you be like us, you know. But yeah, I've cried a lot, you know, I used to hide. But my dad used to tell me, you know, it doesn't matter how people look at you, but it's how you look at yourself. If you think you're incredible, you can do things, you can do things. Don't let other people's words and action determine your future. So I think that has been very, every time I cry, he will sit down with me and say, look, you know, it's okay, their ignorance. Don't blame them. They do not know better. Mm-hmm. All right. So I guess there's a lot of conversation with dad. And mom, that I'll be able to overcome all that.
Okay. Mm. Okay. So, and I mentioned I was reading your blog, and you did mention that there was a lot of feeling of, you know, anger about not being able to maybe participate in sports, not being able to dance. I think I read something like that. You know, how did you work through all of that? That anger, that you know, feeling of I can't do everything that everyone else is doing.
I think when I was younger, yeah, I was very upset when, you know, in PE, you know, physical education, when all the kids are in the field and I become the carer of the bags and the watches. You know? So, yeah, and then they are like, you know, dancers, like, you know, we have class balls and all that, right? But then as I say that, I think God has been kind. You know, God has been giving me this kind of heart to forgive and to just persist. So a lot of times I read a lot, I write a lot. I think I start writing diary when I was very, very young. Oh. So I write down all my emotion, all my hurt, all my pain. I think through writings, I find answers or I find comfort, you know. Yeah. So I think when I was younger, I think going to books is very important. To read more, you know, to try to understand why are things happening in this world, why is it happening to me, you know. So through that knowledge and through that support, I think I was able to overcome all that.
Yeah, because, you know, this wasn't a time where the internet was so readily available, you know, so there wasn't that many, you know, like now you can find support groups so much easier and all of that. Did you have that kind of support, you know, like people who, you know, maybe also had polio as well and who also were facing the same kind of things that you were?
I think when I was younger, I've never met another OKU. I think it was only when I grew up in my 20s. Mm-hmm. Then I started to make effort to meet up. Because I think we are very individual and we are very isolated. Mm. And as you said, in the past, we don't have internet. We don't have social media to connect us like now. Mm. So the only time to meet up is like if they organize, you know, the OKU, Persatuan Orang Cacat, organize something. And I wasn't involved until in my 20s. Okay. So I think at that time, I wasn't able to get that kind of support, but it's more of the internal part of me that tried to make it better. Mm-hmm. I think it's very important. It's also a message for a lot of my OKU friends out there. Sometimes it's really, you know, a lot of people say, oh, go to this support group, go to that support group, you know. I think that's important, but as long as you yourself are not able to look to you and say, oh, you're okay, you're not any different. You're maybe a bit different, but you are okay, you know. So that way you fight your way through. You know, you have to overcome yourself before you get support from other people. So even though you have thousands of people supporting you from outside, if innerly you are not able to overcome yourself, I think that's extremely hard for a lot of us.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, just coming to terms with whatever you have, even if you're not, let's say, in the OKU category, for example, you know, people still struggle with, you know, just facing up to themselves. So, yeah, I guess that's a universal message for anybody, really. Yeah. When you were at school, you decided to pursue a career in medicine. You know, what made you want to become a doctor?
I wanted to be a lawyer.
Oh, you're a lawyer? Sorry.
A lot. Okay. I talk a lot. So I remember once I went back to my general practitioner, who was my family doctor, and he was like, you know, what would you like to do when you grow up? I said, oh, I think I'll pursue the career of a lawyer. He said, why? Why would you want to do that? Why can't you be a doctor? And I said, it's so hard, you know, I have to go overseas, you know. I'm not a very bright student. I know I won't be able to get local university, you know. So he said, no, you know, consider being a doctor because that's where you can do a lot more in helping people, especially for people who are in your position, OKU, that you can inspire them. Mm. I think that was the starting point where I said, oh, okay, let's consider being a doctor. And then plan, you know, okay, after SPM, you know, we are old timers, we do SPM.
Same.
You know, we do SPM, then we go to colleges, then we go to university, then you plan your way out. The moment you decide to do something, I decided to do something, that's where you start to plan.
Okay. And so you did. You went and did you did medicine.
Yes, in India.
In India, yeah.
In Bangalore, India, KMC. Yeah.
And how was that? I mean, were people very, I mean, did they treat you any differently, or was it just, okay, Felicia's one of us?
I think the reason they treat me differently is not really because I'm an OKU, it's because I'm the only Chinese in the class. So they used to make fun of my name. They used to, like, you know, oh, are you Jackie Chan's sister? You know? So I think I guess the reason we were in medical is because we want to help somebody. Mm-hmm. So I think they are a little bit more, have more empathy. Okay. So they have never really treat me differently. Yeah, okay. I'm very grateful for my university friends and teacher as well. Yeah, but my teachers give me special treatment. I can come a little bit late to class because they know I walk very slow. And especially when the lift in India, you know, they break down, so you have to walk 5 floors up. They know that I take times, you know. Okay. So the teachers wait for me. My lecturers wait for me. Yeah, they're very kind.
Very kind of them. And I mean, just moving to India, I mean, how was that, you know, that whole experience of, you know, uprooting from where you were in Malaysia, going all the way there to study by yourself? Was that the first time that you were kind of living out alone?
No, I think I've been in, when I'm doing college, I already stayed, I'm away from my family for 2 years.
Okay.
But I think what helps is my brother was there. My brother, okay. And at the time, my brother's girlfriend, my sister-in-law was there. So I think the challenges was actually learning. You know, when you go the first day I went to college, all right, they speak in Indian English. I have no understanding of a single word. So it took me a couple of weeks before I actually understand what they're trying to say. So for the first 2 weeks in my class, attending lectures, I have no idea what they're talking about. So that's when my friends give me their notes and say, oh, this is what he said.
Oh dear,
but he's okay. Shaking his head and he's telling me everything. So it was the challenges. I think other than that, as I said, I've been blessed. You know, when I was there, my house owner are very kind to me. They helped me to adjust. My brother helped me to adjust. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it was good. Yeah, it was a very, very good experience. Although the studies is very hard.
Of course.
Yeah, it's extremely hard. You know, you have to go through a lot of understanding of the topics and all that. But yet, it was a very good experience in India.
Okay. I'm speaking today to Dr. Felicia Chang. She is a palliative care practitioner. And we are discussing, you know, how she became a doctor. And we're going to find out after this quick break how she eventually got into palliative care. This is Feminist Fridays on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. This is Feminist Fridays on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. In the studio with me today is Dr. Felicia Chang. She is a palliative care practitioner. She's also somebody who was diagnosed with polio when she was aged 1, and because of that, it impacted the ability of her right leg to grow. So, Felicia, you qualified as a doctor, obviously, and then you came, you came back to Malaysia. But I was reading that you couldn't quite manage some of the active duties that were required of, you know, young doctors like yourself at the time. What happened? What were some of the difficulties that you faced?
I think when we were in I did my housemanship in hospital, Teluk Intan, mm-hmm. and we were required to attend to different kind of patient. And when I'm talking about acute, it's probably I'm talking about a patient that comes in with an accident, you mm-hmm. know. So what is required of us is we require to be very fast in dealing with the blood loss and everything. And I find it's very hard for me to run towards the patient. And sometimes when we were doing resuscitation, we actually need to jump on the table,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah,
it's not really jump on the table. It's really to position yourself in so that we don't do more harm than good. And I find that it's extremely hard for me. And if I'm on call, you know, we have a patient, like, for example, a baby that require immediate attention. So I think my challenges is because I'm not able to move fast enough. So I become very frustrated, like, you know. And I don't want to put my patient into jeopardy. Mm-hmm. And if because of my slowness and something happened to them, I don't think so I can live with myself. I think that's the reason that at the back of my mind, acute medicine is not something that I'll pursue. So no emergency department, you know, no acute settings because of my leg, yeah.
Okay. So then when did you kind of decide that, you know, palliative care was the thing that was, you know, the area that you wanted to pursue?
I think palliative care found me rather than I found. And people ask me, how do you go into it? I said, it's actually a calling. I remembered when I was in my first year of my medical, of MO, we call it MO ship.
Yeah.
All right, I was in Hospital Manjung. And that time, there is a department called Palliative Care Department. And at the same time, I have problems with my leg. I have started to have a lot of pain and a lot of a weakness of my over my leg. And I remember telling my pengarah and say, look, I really can't do acute. I can't do calls anymore because I just can't cope. And he said, why don't you take over all the clinics? And one of them is palliative care. And I find that when I was in palliative care, I enjoyed the work. It wasn't acute. A lot of my patients are very advanced in the cancer. Mm. And when I sit with them, I find that the time that I spend with them are very meaningful. I can add value into their care. So that's why I considered, I prayed about it and said, look, is this something that is where I wanted to go? And it happened that a lot of those, because I'm from City Awan, Hospital Manjung is just very nearby. So a lot of those patients are somebody I know, my parents' friends or my friends' parents. So I find a lot more meaning in helping people that I love and I care for.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that's where I decided, yep, this is where I wanted, this is what I wanted to do.
Okay. And you were mentioning that you were getting a lot of pain. And I read that, you know, you had something called post-polio syndrome. You know, what is that? What happened there?
Yeah. It was new to me as well.
Yeah.
I remember I was working in, from Hospital Manjung, I actually asked to transfer to Hospital Selayang. That's where I my Dr. Mary Kedosa and Dr. Richard Lim, they're my bosses.
Yeah.
And I remember I was working for a while with them for about a year. And one day I woke up not able to move my lower limbs. That means my leg. I can't move. I'm literally paralyzed, you know. I remember they were like, oh, we come and rescue you. So there's nothing to rescue. You can't open the door. The door is closed. So I say, let me just see what it goes. About 4 hours later, after that, I'll be able to move my leg.
Okay.
Later, I went to a rehab specialist and I said, what's going on? Why can't I move that day, you know? Yeah. Then he said, oh, you have contracted what they call as a post-polio syndrome. It is about 30 years after you first contracted the virus. And this is something like it's a delayed effect of the polio virus. And what it does to you is like you zapped off your energy. So by the time 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I have actually no energy. I can't walk. I can't move, you know.
Yeah.
So that worries me a lot because, you know, when you're in a hospital setting, you can't. You just have to be on the go all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Then that's when I really have to reconsider what I want to do with the rest of my palliative care career.
Right. And so I guess that's sort of when you decided to leave the hospital setting to do that. I mean, so tell me about that, you know.
Yeah. I was, they said, oh, no, it's all right. You sit in the counter, we'll bring patient to you. You know, they're very kind. You know, they're trying to be, they know how much I love palliative care. But at the same time, it is not practical. You can't bring a patient and a bed to come to me, you know. I have to go to them. So I spoke to my my two bosses and said, look, it's just that I need to quit. But I love it so much. What can I do? I can't. They said, why don't you go to Klinik Kesehatan? You know, you're seeing unfortunately, at the time, it was perceived as seeing cold cough. You know, you don't have to move a lot, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So, but I said, that's not my interest. My interest has always been in palliative care.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of my bosses actually contacted Dr. Ednan. He's also my ex-boss in Hospice Malaysia and said, look, she's really interested in palliative care. Can she come to you and you work something out?
Mm-hmm.
Because at the time, I already decided to quit from the Ministry of Health.
Mm-hmm,
yeah,
mm-hmm.
So that's where I jumped ship to NGO and stayed there. I think stayed in hospice for 7 years.
Okay.
And I lead a palliative care in Asunta Palliative Care Centre for 3 years. So
okay.
I was with NGO for about 10 years
after that. Wow. And I think I might have got ahead of myself. For somebody who doesn't understand what palliative care is, you know, how would you describe that to them?
I think palliative care is... We have palliative care education or we have palliative care medicine.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, there's a subspecialization in our medical field.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just like you are a doctor, you're a surgeon, then you become a cardiosurgeon. You know, so it's the same. You're a physician, then you come to become a palliative care physician. So what it does, what it means is we are taking care of patients who are very ill.
Mm-hmm.
We have life limiting illnesses, And what we do for them is mainly pain management, and we talk about end-of-life care. We support them in their journey. So we talk about supporting them emotionally, spiritually. So it is really about a holistic care that we can take care of our patient most of the time facing end-of-life, yeah. as well as to guide their family as to what to prepare for the next 1 year. We don't have 1 year, seriously. Next few days or next few months, right? So this is our bread and butter is actually pain management. But the rest of it is more of it's in a package. We deal with the patient and the family as a package so that we can help them facing end-of-life care.
Yeah, and I mean, preparing patients for the arrival of death, I imagine that is, you know, not an easy task. How do you actually even kind of prepare yourself to, you know, to even to start helping somebody who is, you know, at the end of their life?
I think initially it was hard. The beginning, I think for all of us in palliative care, the first few years was hard because we are not able to come in terms of with a lot of things. Mm. That's the reason there's a lot of people who refuse to take part in palliative care is because they think it's too depressing.
Yeah, I can imagine.
So, but then at the same time, I think we learn over the years, there are things that, okay, we tried our best, but we can't change the outcome. Like, for example, 100% of our patient is dying, going to die. You know, our mortality rate is the highest, 100%, right? So we have to work through ourselves and say, look, for me, I go through a lot of processing in the first 2 years of my life, to tell myself, is this somewhere you want to go? If I decided to do palliative care, what are some of the things that I need to understand about myself, about the people around me? Am I able to go through all this emotional up and downs, turmoils, roller coaster? But for me, it's prayers. I think prayer come into play because I always believe this is my calling. Yeah. So I say, if this is my calling, God will provide me the strength and the comfort to go through all that. And it's true enough. Every time I cried I go through very, very tough time, I just pray and say, God, if this is what you asked me to do, you better provide me with a strong heart, with a strong mind, so that I can continue to help and do your calling. Yeah. I think to me, it is through prayers and support of my family that I can overcome all the emotional discomfort. I would say it wasn't really a bad thing because then you come to know yourself better.
Yeah.
And you become less petty. You become like, everyone is going to, at the end of it, everyone's going to die. Yeah. But we can actually live better if we understand that we have an expiry date.
Yeah. So I guess it gives you a renewed sense of life, actually, having to deal with death on such a constant basis. And just speaking about the patients that you do help, needs aside, so you manage their pain and all of that, but what sort of their psychological needs, their emotional needs, how do you sort of cater to those things?
I think a lot of people would think that, once I've cancer, it's the end. Mm. No, once I've cancer, I'll die in pain.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of myth in relates to cancer and to end-of-life care. So one of our role is to actually go through with them what is their fear. Bear in mind that a lot of people say, I'm not afraid to die. Die itself is not that fearful, but dying process is very fearful. Will I go into severe pain like what my neighbor used to do, scream in pain, Will I go into a deep depression, or will I actually burden my family member all that? So these are the questions that they have in mind. But because nobody wants to talk about it, it's like a big white elephant in the room. Patient's dying, but everybody pretend that he's going to get better and refuse to address those issues. And that makes them very frustrated and they climb up. They refuse to talk. So when we go in, we give them a space, a safe space, a safe space and opportunity to talk about their emotion.
Yeah.
A lot of time we can't fix it. We are not there to fix problem. We are there to support and facilitate the journey. So if they tell me that, I'm very depressed. Why? What makes you so depressed? So we try to identify the source of the sadness. And if there is a myth, like they will tell me, I'm very sad because, when I die, I will not be able to seek forgiveness from somebody. So I said, would you like to do it now? Why not do it now rather than wait till, you are not able to talk or you're not able to make decision? So we facilitate reconciliation with friends, with a family member, all right? Mm. So sometimes one of my patients say, this is the best thing that happened to me. And I asked why. He said, oh, you know, when I was younger, I worked so hard to be able to provide for the family. I've never seen my children grow up, you know, and now they do not know how to communicate with me. So then we talk about it, you know, we give suggestion, you know, we try to see what is their likes, what is their dislike. So at the end, he said, wow, I didn't know that I can do that, you know. Even at the end of life, they can achieve something. Yeah. And that's very meaningful for them. So our role is to be able to be there to facilitate. We don't fix problem. We facilitate communication between the people that they love. I think that's how we support them psychosocially.
Okay. And the other aspect, of course, of your job is also helping the caregivers themselves, who, you know, are sometimes, you know, under extreme stress and, you know, sad. And like you said, you know, not accepting that the person that they love is going to go. What sort of care do you provide to the caregivers?
I think information is extremely important, because some of the patients' family, when they're in the hospital, a lot of time when the doctors are doing rounds, they are not around. So they don't get the information as to, you know, what's going to happen. They may say that, oh, you go home, you know, your father don't have a long time to go, probably have 6 weeks to go. But when they come home, they're really at a loss. All right. So what I do is we go through all the information from the hospital and try to explain it to the family member. So we try to manage the expectation. Okay, what is your expectation? Oh, I expect my dad to walk again in 3 weeks' time. But your dad is, you know, is going through a dying process. I don't think so he can walk in 3 weeks' time. But how can we make his life better? All right, even though he can't walk. All right, how can we do that? And then we give ideas how to take care of their mouth care, how to take care of the body, you know, how to make sure that they serve the medication in the correct dose, in the correct frequency, all right, and who to call when they have problems, okay, how to they get support, the respect care. You know when you're taking care of a very ill patient, you're very tired all the time. You're actually on duty 24/7.
Yeah.
You know, you can't sleep. Even though you're sleeping, you can't sleep because you're worried next door something happened to your father, right?
Yeah.
So we teach them how to take off a day for themselves or a couple of hours, getting another caregiver in and all that. So by giving ideas and also reviewing on a 2 or 3 weekly basis, we can help them to cope better. All right, sometimes when patients are sick, they can be quite nasty sometimes, you know,
because
they are really uncomfortable. So we have to manage patients' emotion, you know, and also help the family member to understand the reason they are being so unpleasant is because they're really uncomfortable.
Yeah.
So try to meet halfway. So that's how we support caregiver, by giving them information, by giving them practical things to do, all right, and also deal with their emotion on a regular basis.
Okay. That's a tough job you have, Felicia. And another very tough aspect of your job, I think, is, I mean, dealing with elderly patients who are going to pass on is one thing, but you also sometimes have to deal with children who are at the end stages of whatever illness. I think that is something that is very difficult for you personally.
Yes, I think, I mean, like, if you always think that, older people have gone through experience in life,
they've
you know.
They've lived their life,
yeah. they've lived their life, but children that comes, like my youngest baby is only about 2 weeks old, all right, and he was born with certain syndromes that we know that it's not going to be more than 4 weeks. Mm-hmm. All right, so that was very young. So that was dealing with the parents, you know. I have to work with the parents as to how to... It's very hard to say to get over things or to deal with it. I don't think so we can ever able to deal with it, you know. But to be able to be there for them when things happen, explain and make sure that the baby is fine. And I think the hardest for me is if they're in their teens. I think teenager, they are neither adult nor they're neither children, right?
Yeah.
And yet, they are, even if you're not sick, you're going through a very hormonal, a lot of hormonal changes. So when they are ill, it becomes a lot more difficult because they want to make decision. A lot of those decisions may not be good for them. And parents intervene, but when parents intervene, they think that they're trying to take their life away from them. So being a facilitator in that situation is extremely hard because you have to deal with a very distressed teenager, adolescents, and a very distressed parents. All right. So I think that was, I think my hardest is dealing with adolescents and teenager because they are in a different world. Yeah, but we can. It's just that we just need a little bit more patience, a little bit more time with them. All right, to just sometime, if they want to play computer game, you just have to sit next to them and play computer game. You know, just so be where they are.
Yeah, it's
meet
a lot
them
of
where they are.
A lot of adapting, I assume. Yes. Yeah, that is pretty much your job as well, yeah. Adapting to all the different needs. So, I mean, what keeps you going? You know, how do you? Like you say, you know, I think a lot of people find this job very depressing because, like we said, there's no, I suppose, happy ending. There's no miracle cure that's going to come and such like that. So how do you get up every day and just do the job that you're doing?
I love my job. I seriously love my job because I think, first of all, I think it's a calling, as I mentioned.
Yeah.
But then the joy of, yes, my patient died. But I always tell myself my patient will die more, what do you call that? At peace because of what I did. Mm-hmm, all right. Mm-hmm, so that gave me aspiration to go to do, because I know for every patient that I help, all right, I make their life better. Yeah. All right. Although the outcome is they died.
Yeah.
All right. So I think that helps me a lot. And having a lot of communication with God and asking the direction, you know, God says go ahead and keep doing what you do. So I have to kind of like, okay, Lord, if you give me that kind of instruction, as I say, give me that kind of strength. So that strength comes from the Lord. Yeah.
Okay. So I mean, you yourself, you know, I mean, you know how some people may feel a bit uncomfortable about around people with different abilities because. You know, they're worried they'll say the wrong things, or, you know, they're worried they might offend you in any way. You know, what advice would you be to them if they have any questions about, you know, you yourself personally?
I think we don't get offended so easily. We are not that, you know, oh, you just, because you call me a cripple, I blow it out of proportion. But come and ask us, you know, be curious about us and find out more about us, okay? For example, I have children. Children come to me and say, look, mom, they tell the parents, mom, look at that girl, you know. She walks so weird, you know. She walks with such, it's not normal, you know. Yeah. So if I have the opportunity, I would talk to the child. I say, well, why do you think that I walk very weird, you know? They say, oh, because, you know, you walk with a limp, you know. Then I will say, come, hold your hand, you know. I show them my caliper. That's what I'm wearing now, right? I say, I'm a transformer, you know. So in the nighttime, I go help people, you know. Yeah. So sometimes it's just to laugh it over, you know, to laugh over it. And it's not a big deal. Seriously, it's not. Being an OKU is not a big deal. To us, we have been through it and we overcome it, all right? But to a lot of people, they feel like, you know, oh, should I help? You know, sometimes crossing the road or going up the steps, right? Yeah. Should I help? If I help, am I going to be like, you know, people will think that I look down upon them. No, you know, just go and ask, you know, do you need help? Okay, and if they do, just help. And we are very thankful. I have problem getting up the steps. So sometimes when there's people around them, or I just say, oh, excuse me, is it possible for you to help me up the steps? And people are very willing.
Yeah,
and you can see that they feel so good after. No, they're a bit like, you know, a bit helpless as what to do. But when we tell them what to do, they were like, oh, I did my good deed today, you know. So just be curious. Come and talk to us. Ask us questions, you know. We are not, okay, you people are not alien. We are just like you and me, you know.
And I guess there's always that fear of asking, right? You don't want to offend, right? That is the thing. But I suppose the worst that could happen is the person will say, you know, I'm fine, right? I don't need any help.
Yeah. But thank you for offering the help. We always feel that, you know. We feel good when people offer us help, you know, because there are physical things that we are not able to do.
Is there anything else that you would like people to understand about, you know, people who are differently able from, you know, the rest?
I think the challenge is always within yourself. I think the demon is in yourself. Like, you know, a lot of people feel depressed, unhappy, you know. They feel that the world owe them something, you know. A lot of people think, oh, you know, because I'm a handicapped, you know, you must do this for me. Ministry have to do this for me. My parents have to do this for me. Because, you know, I was born not normal, not complete. It's because of your fault, all right? But that is your demon, okay? So for you to be able to do better out there in the real world, all right, you have to overcome this demon. You have to work within yourself and say, nobody owes you anything, you know, all right? Probably you are special because God made you this way, all right, for a purpose. For me, I will never be who I am today if it's not because of my polio, All right? Yeah. So the first battle is within yourself. Okay, if you can overcome yourself either through prayer, to talking to somebody, okay, to getting support from the or other OKUs, all right, you do that. Because once you overcome yourself, that's where you start to realize that, you know, you can contribute back to the society. That's where you say that, okay, it's not about me anymore, it's really about other people. So once you start contributing, once you start helping other people, then you'll find that there's meaning in life. It's really not about you being a handicap. It's really about you being a handicap that can help another person. I think that inspires others to do the same. So for me, to my OKU brother and sister, I tell what my message is like, overcome that demon. Then you look out instead of looking in. Then you'll do it, but you'll be a better person.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much, Felicia. And, you know, if anyone listening would like to get in touch with you, you know, how can we do that?
All right. I can be reached through my email. It's Felicia Chang. At yahoo.com, okay. Or you can call Beacon Hospital.
Yeah. Okay, that's where you're currently practicing, yeah?
Yes.
Okay, all right. Thank you so much. If you missed any part of this interview, do download the podcast, which you can get on our BFM app, which is available on Google Play and the App Store. This has been Feminist Fridays on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.